You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Top politicians, business leaders, and even environmentalists talk seriously about whether it will cost 2% or 10% of the world's economy to switch away from fossil fuels. A new paper says these emperors have no clothes. Estimates of the costs and benefits of limiting climate change are impossible. And that's according to a peer-reviewed study by Drs. Richard A. Rosen and Etteltraud Gunther. It's pretty shocking stuff when you hear what those official estimates leave out. Dr. Rosen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, first of all, I have to ask, who are you to question the complex work of whole teams of experts when it comes to the economics of mitigating climate change? Please tell us about your own background and that of your co-author.
Yes, well, my background is such that I've been an energy systems planner for about 35 or more years now. I've done a lot of detailed modeling work of the energy system, which, of course, is essential in analyzing climate change. And I've provided expert testimony and testimony in various federal lawsuits for the last 35 years. Even though I'm a physicist by training, I've been doing the economics of energy system work for, as I say, about 40 years now. My co-author, Dr. Gunther, is a tenured faculty member of the business school at the Technical University in Dresden, and she's also done a lot of work on scenarios and how scenarios should be put forth and uncertainty dealing with the future.
Well, before we get to specifics, do you think these economic predictions of the cost of avoiding catastrophic climate change are worth doing at all?
No, I don't. Not for the long run. I think that the modeling work that's been done, as much of the work that I did decades ago, should be focused on implementation of plans to prevent climate change. So over the long run, and for these models, long run means, as long as 100 years or more, you really cannot make any scientifically credible economic forecast, or probably forecast of almost anything for that length of time.
Well, let's dig into this. I was truly surprised when I read your peer-reviewed paper coming out in the journal Technological Forecasting and Social Change. Maybe we should start with the models. They're called Integrated Assessment Models, or IAMs. What are they trying to do?
Yeah, well, it is very important to go back to the models and, in fact, the process under which they started. Most of them, as far as I know, were really geared to the IPCC climate modeling effort going back for several versions of the IPCC assessments. As your readers may know, or listeners, we're now up to the fifth assessment, and an assessment has been done roughly every 6 or 7 years over the past 3 decades. Now, these integrated assessment models are basically an attempt to link a very simple form of an economic forecast for the economy to the energy use of the economy and also to the way land is used, because land can cause emissions of greenhouse gases. And basically, the attempt then is to, once you look at the greenhouse gas emissions due to economic growth or economic change, then the greenhouse gas emissions are then linked to a simple climate model, which produces a rough estimate of the temperature increase that will result from those greenhouse gas emissions. So when the models are called integrated assessment, it's an attempt to integrate economic forecasting with energy system changes, dealing with the burning of fossil fuels and what have you, to climate change and land use change.
Good. Now, that seems pretty clear. Now, if you come to me with an idea for a business or changes to an existing business, I'm going to require a business model with projections of what things will cost, and governments want the same. What's the harm of trying to provide that when it comes to climate mitigation?
Well, there's several different layers of uncertainty involved in trying to make these forecasts, as with any business, as you point out. The problem is that, I doubt you'll find many businesses that actually make forecasts for more than about 5 years, maybe 10 years, in terms of input to their business plans. I've never personally heard of a business that forecasted for more than 10 years or so, and even oil companies don't do it for much more than about 20 years. But the first 20 years is in almost not very important in these climate projections because not much can or does happen in these model runs in the first 20 years. People are mostly focused on, as I say, at least 50, but primarily 100 years. They're mostly focused on what's going to happen to the climate by the year 2100, okay? And the reason they're looking at that is because they want to look at the long run in terms of what's the, quote, best way to make investments to perhaps prevent climate change, what they call mitigate climate change. So the short run doesn't do much for you. In other words, forecasting just for the short run, 10 or 20 years, doesn't do much for these exercises because, in fact, it's very hard to change the world much over the next 20 years. Most of the change is only feasible in the long run, and people look at various scenarios for the long run. And the kind of scenarios they want to create for the long run are things like what they might call business as usual economic growth throughout the world for the next 100 years versus various levels of investment to try to prevent climate change to keep the temperature increase, say, to only 4 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Celsius, and in the best scenarios these days, about 2 degrees Celsius. So that's why they're looking at the long run, because the climate takes a fairly long time to change.
Now, I was really stumped when I read in your study that the models used for the Stern report and the 2007 IPCC report, quote, do not include any estimates of the likely future damage due to climate change at all. Now, does that mean things like the costs of Hurricane Katrina or the $60 billion for Hurricane Sandy is just left out of the model?
Yes, for most of the models, that's correct. They make no attempt to put what we call in the field damage costs in. There have been some integrated assessment models that have included damage costs in the past, but number one, they've been extremely simplistic, even more simplistic than many of these integrated assessment models that I criticize. And number two, they don't form most of the basis for the IPCC reports because most of the literature is not generated from those models.
Wow. I mean, it seems like the violent storms, the rising seas, the droughts that could affect agriculture, those are one of the reasons we want to mitigate climate change, and yet they're not able to put those in the predictions. You point out another huge gap in this process, and it has to do with the inability to clearly state what the baseline we're going to use to compare with some future. Can you explain that problem a little bit for us?
Yeah, so in order to look at the economics of mitigating climate change, you're basically comparing two economic forecasts. You're comparing the economic forecast, what we might call a base case or reference case, where you assume that there are no major actions taken to prevent climate change. That's the base case. Then you want to compare that to a scenario where you take major action, as I said earlier, perhaps in the best case, to try to limit the temperature increase to 2 degrees Celsius over the next 100 years. So that's a mitigation scenario. So you have a certain cost each year for the mitigation scenario produced by the model. You have a certain cost each year produced in the base case with no mitigation options or actions taken. And then you just subtract the two economic results year by year, and you get the difference in the cost, or if you have negative costs, the benefit to mitigating climate change. So that's what you're looking at, the differences in cost between two scenarios out for roughly 100 years.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Richard Rosen from the TELUS Institute. We're talking about his new paper, The Economics of Mitigating Climate Change, What Can We Know? The other big gap seems to be if something that we didn't expect happens, the black swan events, perhaps there's a virus escapes and causes mass deaths, or we run out of oil. They don't even seem to consider peak oil. You talk about that, don't you?
Yes. Well, as I started to say earlier, and we should really discuss this a bit more, there are various kinds of uncertainty involved in trying to make projections for either a base case or a mitigation case. And many of them are neglected by the modeling community that runs these models for the IPCC studies. Now, one kind of uncertainty, as we just discussed, is that basically damage costs of the effect of climate change on the world are omitted. So that's a very big uncertainty. They assume zero is the answer, and clearly zero cost is not the answer. But another kind of uncertainty, as you say, is black swan, or very unusual events or low probability events that might have a very large impact on the world. In general, those are also completely ignored in these models. So, for example, in the base case, when we have business as usual, it could be that we'll not run out of oil, but run low on cheaper sources of oil in the next 30, 40, 50 years. Actually, I think that's quite likely. But that kind of a peak oil type of argument is often ignored, because usually these model scenarios assume very modest prices for fossil fuels all the way out to the year 2100. They sometimes take into account that lower supplies will lead to higher prices, but usually the numbers are very modest. Another kind of uncertainty that comes in to these projections is just the basic uncertainties in all the technology costs that are involved to mitigate climate change. So, for example, I'm sure most of your listeners realize that solar photovoltaic cells are now coming into the market, and more people are putting them on their roofs or office buildings. Those generate electricity, of course, and they're what we call renewable sources of electricity. But what is the cost of a sort of solar photovoltaic cell going to be in 50 years or 100 years? I would argue we have basically no idea. No one knows. It's very hard to even project costs like that for 5 or 10 years down the road. The Chinese have made so many photovoltaic cells in the last 5 years that the cost today is far lower than anyone would have guessed just 5 years ago. So there are hundreds of assumptions on technology costs, the way technologies will work, what technologies will be available, in what magnitude will the availability exist. All these assumptions have to be made year by year for every technology, for every region of the world going out for 100 years. So we maintain that just that level of uncertainty alone means that none of these economic forecasts can have any scientific credibility.
I'm not sure that I understood your points about energy efficiency. What are you saying in this paper about that?
Okay, well, energy efficiency, again, is a very important approach to mitigating climate change and to, again, making our economies more efficient. Energy efficiency means that we buy technologies that use less energy to accomplish the same task as the previous generation of that same technology. So, for example, under United States federal law, many appliances that we put into our homes have improved their efficiency tremendously since the 1970s. Refrigerators are one of the best cases, where the average of use of electricity for refrigerators to cool your food for the same size refrigerator has decreased by more than 50% since the 1970s. And many environmental groups and energy planning groups, consumer groups, argue correctly that improving the energy efficiency of all the devices that we use that consume energy is probably the first thing you should do to try to mitigate climate change. Just use fewer fossil fuels, use less of any kind of energy, and then there'll be less emission of carbon dioxide. So the first point to understand is that energy efficiency is usually almost your first consideration to mitigate climate change. And yet these integrated assessment models have a major weakness in their model structure and in the equations in the models, because they don't have any detail about how to improve energy efficiency. They don't look at the costs and benefits clearly of investing more in more energy efficient technologies and appliances. And they usually have very rigid constraints on the maximum amount of energy efficiency you can induce through price or other changes in these models, even over 100 years. So they don't look at the more serious scenarios that are quite possible, where we implement energy efficiency much more quickly and comprehensively in the economy than has been the case historically.
And the other problem that bothers me is we're talking now about human systems, and it seems like we humans are co-evolving with another system that's in gigantic flux, which is the natural world, and partly due to climate change, it's changing. But other things, fishery scientists, for example, have predicted there'll be no important commercial fishery after about 2040, and we know species are going extinct. All sorts of things are happening in nature. How can we plug those into the models?
Well, it would be very difficult, but as we said in the beginning, those issues are really not plugged into the models at all. I mean, the models have very limited capabilities because they are already so complex, even though I criticize them for being too simplistic. So there's a real trade-off here between complexity and whether the model can actually run and produce an answer on a computer in a reasonable amount of time. So our interaction with the natural world, with, you know, animal and plant species, with the oceans, is not treated in the models. The only thing the models do take into account is roughly the rate of absorption of carbon dioxide into the ocean so that it falls out of the atmosphere. So that's taken into account to produce the net temperature changes due to greenhouse gas emissions.
So you think the IPCC and government experts should just stop making these reports on the cost of combating climate change?
Well, again, we should be clear for your listeners that there are three reports that the IPCC produces each time it does an assessment. Report number one is on the physics of the climate change. That was released for this assessment back in September. So that certainly, I think, should go ahead because that's science and that's physics and chemistry, and presumably one can do better over time as one see how the Earth evolves and climate change evolves. So I'm all in favor of continuing work on the physics and chemistry of climate change. The second report, which was just released about 2 weeks ago, is on what's called the impact and adaptation. So it's on the issue of what's the impact of climate change on the world, both the natural world, the ecological systems, as well as the human societies and human aspects of the world. That also, I think, needs to continue because we're learning a tremendous amount in those areas about how human societies have to adapt and cope and what needs to be done to prevent more damage to both the ecology of the world and damage to its humanity in terms of starvation and what have you. The third report is the one that I think is most problematic, which is about to be released in the next week or two. And that's the report that focuses on mitigating climate change and in particular the economics. So the economics is only part of the Working Group 3 report, but it's an important part. And what we conclude, as others have concluded in other published papers, we believe that the overall results for the economics costs and benefits of mitigating climate change for the next 100 years are, again, so uncertain. Uncertainty is so powerful here that those reports, those results on the economics should not be published because they're not credible. And we know we have to mitigate and prevent climate change anyway to preserve human civilization and to preserve the ecological systems of the Earth. So it's not like we need to find out that there are costs and benefits to mitigate climate change as a reason to go ahead or not go ahead. We don't have a choice. We must go ahead.
And I agree with that. And I think that's the final conclusion of your paper. It's not that it's not worth knowing this. It's just that no matter what it costs, we have to try and save the climate that we need to survive. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, the cost comes in the following way. As I say, 100-year projections of costs or benefits aren't relevant because we can't know them. We can't do it. So if we can't do something, then we can't depend on it for making policy decisions. But the cost should come in the shorter to medium term, as I started to say earlier, in terms of doing the best planning possible to mitigate climate change sort of on a 5-year by 5-year basis. So, you know, clearly we shouldn't ignore costs and benefits. We should try to be smart and implement those technologies that will mitigate climate change that are the least costly and the most cost effective for society going forward every 5 years. But the point is that as we go forward, we'll learn more about the costs, more about the problems of implementing certain technologies, more about, you know, the acceptability to people of different technologies, more about how to implement them in the course of implementation. And then we can, you know, adjust and fine-tune our implementation plans, you know, every few years, which is only sensible. So we need to pay attention to cost, but over the short to medium term, in terms of what's a smart way to go about mitigating climate change, not over the very long run, which can't be done and therefore shouldn't have an impact on our long-run thinking.
Our guest has been Dr. Richard A. Rosen from the TELUS Institute in Boston. The paper title is The Economics of Mitigating Climate Change, What Can We Know? Find links to Dr. Rosen and the full text of that paper we've been discussing in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Dr. Rosen, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.